Coming out of our laundry area there, the washing machine, I think it tipped over. No, maybe it hadn't. One of the cupboards had fallen over anyway. And there was stuff strewn across the floor. We sort of pushed it to one side and climbed over bits and pieces and went out to see what was going on. And noticed that our house was still basically standing. One wall on the western side, I think it was. The side facing Kajuna Shopping Centre anyway, up the trail road end, was leaning out. Dad's boat was parked just underneath and it hadn't fallen on the boat. And he was hugely relieved. And there'd been damage to the roof. Apparently my mother had told my sister sometime later that when she was in the kitchen, a stick of timber flew past her. And that's when she decided to forego any more cooking and go and get Dad up and get us all out. But the houses around us had been basically demolished. Our next door neighbour's place, Roy and Nola Smith, they were away on holidays with their kids and all their stuff was strewn everywhere. I remember going out with Mum and picking through the stuff, and Mum had a real sense of mementos and keepsakes and saying, "These photos are not too badly damaged, pick them up. I can dry those ones out. Pick up these things, you'll want this, sports trophies, things like that." And so we spent some time collecting the stuff for them. And Jerry Rowe, the footballer, lived behind us, or his widow lived there, because I think he died not long before the cyclone. And checking to see that they were okay. It was just looking around, having a look at what was going on, sussing out what we had. How were we going to collect the water, because we'd been told not to touch the water mains. And we decided that we'd use the rubbish bins, and I don't know where they came from. Maybe Mum cleaned them out in a hurry, I don't know, but the plastic 56-litre bins they are now. We used those and we'd get the water off the roof, and that was water that we used for washing, for cooking. If we wanted to drink it, Mum would boil it up. We just collected the rainwater and that was going to be the water we needed. We'd work that out. Dad had been a fisherman and going on fishing trips. We had the camping burners for cooking. So we had gas. We had a freezer stocked with food. And the stuff in the freezers kept for about 4 days. You know, with the chest freezer, open the lid and the stuff would stay frozen and keep everything else. So we knew we had food for about 4 or 5 days. It wasn't going to be too big of a problem. And the food that Mum had cooked, plenty to go around the neighbourhood. But anyway, in all of this, somewhere along the line, we noticed that our chooks, because we had some chooks, were in a heap, looking absolutely dead, smelling of damp feathers, lifeless. And Dad said, "Well, looks like we're going to have to dig a hole and bury them. I'll do that later." And he disappeared. And for the next 3 days, I don't know how much sleep he got, because we hardly ever saw him. And I don't know whether he slept much at all. I often say that the next 72 hours he didn't sleep. He might have grabbed an hour or two here and there. But it was full on for Dad. He was back at work with the evacuation, with organising things. Him and Jack Anderson and Ian Shepherd and quite a few other people. Noel Liner, George Redman. A lot of the old senior officials in the government, all involved in this. And anyway, 2 days later, these chooks still hadn't been buried. And Mum was beginning to complain. And we noticed that one of them started to move. And then another one. And before too long, these chooks had dried out and come back to life again. We had all our chooks. Mum said, "Right, there's fresh meat and there's fresh eggs." So, you know, the chooks actually survived. So now when I see a wet chook, I tell everybody, wait. The other thing we also noticed too after Tracy was that we had a huge bumper crop of lemons and limes on our citrus bushes in the backyard. A bumper crop, big fleshy fruit on long stems. And someone had said that the mango stems that year had been extra long, and it's said by the Aboriginals at the time that that was an indication that there was a big storm coming. and you know, the birds disappearing and all. And I know that now, whenever there's a cyclone in the wind and they say how strong it is, you know, category 5, I can still hear the birds. No, it's not going to be too big a problem. The mango stems, no, they're not as long. These things still stick around as a as an indicator of the strength of the cyclone. With Tracy, there was a huge amount of debris on the road. Iron, twisted poles, wood, splintered wood, clothing. And people were riding up and down the road in cars, and the tyres had popped, and they were just driving on the hub, and they were going anywhere to check out who was still around, what was the damage. And, you know, people might say that it's curiosity, that it's, there is a term for it, and they do it now. Whenever there's a disaster, everyone flocks to see what it is, to sticky beak. But I think it's also a genuine need to go and see that someone's okay, to go and see that that something survived, or to go and view the extent of the damage, to congratulate yourselves that you've survived, that your place isn't as badly off. You know, there are lots of reasons, emotional reasons, and for emotional security that people do this. But I used to marvel at these cars with no tyres, you know, bump, 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 down the road, looking. And people trying to get water out of the fire hydrants with buckets, with rubbish bins, until they were told don't use them. And then there was the looting in the shops. Well, before there was the looting, people had gone up to Casuarina to have a look at the damage, because that was a huge shopping centre for our day. And my brother had also gone up on his bicycle to have a look, and he came back with these bags with dog food in them, and he said, "Mum, there's people up there getting stuff out, and they've all been told that they can take whatever they want, and I brought back some dog food for the dog." And Mum said, "Oh, that's good, but don't go back." He said, "Why not, Mum? There's plenty there." "No, don't go back." And then she said, "Look after the dog, because they're going to go around and they're going to come shooting dogs soon," because she'd been warned that this might happen. And we had a cage that we used to keep our pet rabbits in until we discovered that they could dig. And we had multiple litters of rabbits under the ground until we got rid of them all and gave them away. So anyway, we put the cats into the cage, and then we'd have the dog chained up, and at night the dog would go into the cage or go in wherever Mum and Dad were, because people came looking for the dogs to take them away to shoot them, and it didn't matter whether they were caged or not. And Mum would not leave the house, because she said, "As soon as I leave the house, someone's going to come and shoot the dog." And so Mum stayed there, and we heard about the evacuation going on, and we wondered what was going to happen. Were we going to be evacuated? And I guess in a way it was the sense of excitement, you know, this huge journey, this evacuation. In some way there was a sense of a romantic lure to it, you know, and when's our evacuation going to be? And so anyway, I think it was about 3 days in that Dad came and told Mum that we're going to be evacuated, and just the kids, because Mum said she wouldn't go, she would stay with Dad. And because we're only allowed to take a little bit, we had our TAA Ansett Airway school bags, which were just big enough to put in foolscap size folders and some books. We shoved them full of bits and pieces that we could. We each had our school bags, 3 layers of clothing on, a pair of shoes on our feet. My sister grabbed a favourite toy. I had bought myself a little portable sewing machine about the time of Selma, just after school finished. It was my money that I'd saved up, and so I grabbed that. I left my guitar behind. I bought another one when I got down south. And then we were taken, and I can't remember whether my father came and got us or whether someone else came and got us and took us to the airport. But we got to the airport, and there were thousands of people, hundreds of people there, milling around, people with huge, huge suitcases, men and women, and they were pushing and shoving and streaming out. And we waited, and we waited, And then finally, just before the end of the day, they put us on a plane and they literally shoved us out, hunted us along, got us as quickly as possible out there. I can't remember where they picked us up and put us on the trolley or whether my sisters got dumped on the trolley because they were little. But anyway, we got out there and then into the plane, and there were children everywhere. The seats, normally three seats in a row on one side and two on the other side. We were sitting five adults. If you had a seatbelt, you had a seatbelt. If you didn't, you wedged yourself in. Then we were nursing children on our laps. And there still seemed to be babies on the floor, babies under the seats. And I know that there was a friend in a wheelchair who'd been taken down towards the back of the plane. And other people there with injuries. And I sat next to a girl who was also a similar age to myself. I was 18 at the time. And she was heading back down south. She'd been up on holidays and she was going home. We were heading off towards Sydney. And I think we stopped in Brisbane first and then went from Brisbane to Sydney. But in the meantime, my father had got a message out to his mum to say that we were all well, that we were okay, because at that point they assumed that we were dead because they hadn't heard and nobody knew at the time that there was no way of getting a message out. And I can't remember whether Dad got this through an airline, someone to radio it through from the plane, or whether it was one of the first radios working. But he got this message out and they were all waiting for us to turn up. And when we got to Sydney, well, actually leaving Darwin, it seemed like the plane was never, ever going to leave the ground. It just seemed to have this weight and just couldn't quite make it into the ground. And just before the end of the runway, it lifted. And we were in the air, but I kept waiting for it to drop out of the sky. It was just felt that heavy. We found out afterwards it was one of the heaviest ones. I don't know whether it was the heaviest or not, but it was certainly overloaded. And when we got to Sydney eventually, there was then the stress of all these people around us wanting to know all this information. Who are you? Where'd you come from? Have you done this? Have you done that? And before you could say an answer, someone else would come in and ask another question. And someone realized after a while that we weren't going to be able to answer all these questions and sat down with us, and we just kept saying, we want to go here, we've got to go there, and where do they live, and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, we filled out registration cards. We found the number of a friend in the phone book, and they organised the government taxi to take us out to our friend who lived at Karama. We stayed with them for a couple of days. We rang our grandparents and our aunts and our uncles in Woi Woi, and then organised to get on the train to go out to Woi Woi to stay with them. And while we were in Woi Woi, I thought I was the one who had responsibility of my siblings. I was 18, I had had a job, I had a little bit of money, and I didn't know anything about government handouts or anything like that, or unemployment benefits. I just thought we had to make do with what we had, and all I had was $700. I'm thinking, how long am I going to support the family like this? And we went to the South Asian Army centres to get this clothing that had been donated for the victims of Cyclone Tracy. And sifting through the stuff and saying to my sisters, right, that'll do, that's clean enough, that'll do, that's clean enough. Here's a pair of shoes, a pair of sneakers. And I remember them looking down their nose at me and saying, what? You want us to wear that stuff? It's second-hand stuff. Anyway, I got really stressed out about this because I was still worrying about the money and how to look after them, even though we were staying with relatives. And my sisters complained to my parents over the phone one day, and I thought my parents had come down to rescue my sisters, but they hadn't. They'd come to get them, to take them home. And I then had to go on to uni, but I was then separated from my siblings and sent to another aunt to stay, where the siblings couldn't come and torment me and demand me to buy them this and to buy them that. And I felt really, I felt a little bit of an insult, a bit of an injustice at the time, but, you know, I found out afterwards that there were government handouts And gradually all this thing came to pass, but by the time it all happened, it wasn't necessary because I was on my way to uni, to Canberra, and my father had organised for me to stay with some work colleagues that he knew, and I stayed with them for a few months before getting myself sorted in my accommodation there as well.